A philosopher walks into a lecture hall and calmly argues that some human lives aren't worth living, that eating meat is morally equivalent to racism, and that letting your child die might sometimes be the right choice. The audience doesn't applaud, they riot. Police escorts become necessary. Death threats arrive. This isn't hypothetical. This is what happened to Peter Singer, whose book, Practical Ethics, forces us to confront a terrifying possibility, that our deepest moral convictions might be nothing more than comfortable illusions. Singer doesn't offer feel-good ethics or easy answers. Instead, he hands us a mirror and asks us to look at the reflection honestly, even when what we see makes us recoil. His work has been translated into 15 languages and sparked protests across continents, not because he's cruel, but because he refuses to let sentiment override reason. What makes someone the most influential living philosopher to some and the most dangerous man in the world to others? The willingness to follow logic wherever it leads, even into the darkest corners of our moral universe. We've gotten ethics backward. Most people obsess over sex while treating genuinely consequential moral questions as practicalities. Yet driving raises far more serious ethical issues than bedroom activities. Every time you drive, you risk killing someone and contribute to climate change, devastating future generations. We fixate on consenting adults' private lives while ignoring actions with real moral weight. Then there's the tired refrain, "That's good in theory, but it doesn't work in practice." This misunderstands ethics fundamentally. If a principle fails in practice, it's just bad theory. The problem isn't that ethics is impractical, it's that we've mistaken it for rigid rules, like never lie, that inevitably conflict. Sophisticated ethical thinking develops nuanced systems or focuses on outcomes. Utilitarianism asks, did I produce more well-being than suffering, rather than did I break a rule? Does ethics require God? Plato demolished this millennia ago. Does God approve of actions because they're good, or are they good because God approves? If the former, goodness exists independently. If the latter, morality is arbitrary. Everyday observation confirms the disconnect. Atheists act morally, believers commit atrocities. Cultural relativism collapses under scrutiny. It can't explain moral reform. By this logic, abolitionists were wrong until they convinced enough people. Ethics demands universality. I can't privilege my interests simply because they're mine. This naturally leads toward preference utilitarianism, furthering everyone's interests.
Since World War II, openly racist views have become publicly toxic. But what does equality mean when humans obviously differ in height, intelligence, and ability? Pretending differences don't exist isn't just dishonest, it's unnecessary. The real foundation for equality is ethical, not factual. Equal consideration of interests. An interest matters regardless of whose it is. This principle rejects racism and sexism not by denying differences, but by refusing to let arbitrary characteristics determine whose suffering counts. Crucially, equal consideration doesn't mean equal treatment. After an earthquake, you have two morphine shots. One victim has a crushed leg and screams in agony. Another has a gashed thigh with mild pain. Giving each one shot would be equal treatment, but terrible ethics. Giving both to the crushed leg victim produces far more relief. Equal consideration often requires unequal treatment. That's precisely the point. Even if genetic factors explained IQ differences between populations, this wouldn't justify discrimination. Group averages say nothing about individuals. Our society accepts vast income inequality as fair under equal opportunity. Yet true equality would require equalizing home environments, parental influence, and genetic endowments. This system rewards people lucky enough to inherit valued abilities, distributing rewards based on genetic lottery rather than need. If equal consideration of interests grounds human equality, logic demands we extend this principle beyond our species. Yet speciesists refuse to accept that animal pain matters as much as human pain. This doesn't mean suffering is always equivalent. Humans with greater awareness may suffer more from cancer due to mental anguish about mortality. But sometimes the calculus reverses. Animals with limited understanding may suffer more from capture because they can't comprehend it doesn't mean death. What matters is comparing interests carefully rather than dismissing animal suffering automatically. For most urbanized people, eating animals forms our primary interaction with them. Yet in industrialized societies, meat isn't necessary for survival or health. Animal agriculture converts only 1/4 to 1/10 of plant nutrients into meat while contributing more to global warming than the entire transport sector. Factory farming treats sentient beings as mere flesh-producing machines. By purchasing these products, we support practices that sacrifice major animal interests for minor human taste preferences. We'd be horrified if someone kicked a dog for amusement, yet we fund systematic torture of pigs who are more intelligent than dogs simply because we enjoy bacon. Animal experimentation reveals our speciesism most clearly. Experimenters justify their work by claiming it provides insights about humans, acknowledging crucial similarities between species while treating them radically differently. Not all experiments serve vital medical purposes. The LD50 test determines lethal doses by poisoning animals until 50% die, still used for products like Botox Cosmetic, where mice slowly suffocate as their respiratory muscles become paralyzed. The objections to animal rights ring hollow. We can never know if animals feel pain, but we can never directly experience anyone else's pain, human or animal. Our certainty comes from behavior, and animals in pain behave remarkably like humans in pain. But animals eat each other, yet predators must kill to survive, while we have alternatives. Most decisively, non-human animals cannot reflect on dietary ethics or consider alternatives. We can reflect. We can choose. That's precisely why we're accountable. Killing a self-conscious being may be more serious than killing a merely sentient one, because self-aware beings form desires about their future. The wrong occurs when these preferences are thwarted. Are any non-human animals persons? Washo the chimpanzee learned 350 signs. Coco the gorilla exceeded 500. Both demonstrated time awareness by referring to past and future events. Wild chimpanzees plan and deceive, hiding sexual behavior from dominant males and coordinating to bypass electric fences. Pigs strategically conceal food from competitors. Scrub jays cache food based on anticipated future desires rather than current preferences, planning for who they'll be, not just who they are. This evidence suggests some non-human animals are persons with self-awareness, memory, and intentions. If personhood rather than species membership makes human life significant, then non-human persons deserve similar protection. The wrongness of killing might be better understood as a matter of degree, depending on whether a being is fully a person, a near person, or lacks self-awareness entirely. The abortion debate persists because life develops gradually. The conservative argument conflates species membership with personhood. If human means person, fetuses lack rationality and self-consciousness. If it merely means species member, then species membership becomes arbitrary discrimination. Consciousness emerges around 18 weeks when the cerebral cortex develops synaptic connections. Over 85% of U.S. abortions occur during the first trimester, well before this threshold. The potential person argument fails. Prince Charles lacks a king's rights. Destroying an acorn doesn't equal felling an oak. Early embryos can split into twins up to 14 days post-fertilization. We cannot identify which resulting embryo is the original, suggesting pre-14-day embryos aren't distinct individuals. Voluntary euthanasia occurs at the explicit request of mentally competent persons. The Netherlands legalized it in 2002. Non-voluntary euthanasia applies to those incapable of understanding choice, severely disabled infants, and those permanently lacking decision-making capacity. Since rationality and self-awareness determine killing's wrongness, ending these lives differs from killing normal humans. An estimated 10,000, 40,000 Americans exist in persistent vegetative states, alive biologically but not biographically. Where euthanasia remains illegal, doctors risk prosecution. Yet diagnostic error risks must be weighed against significant, pointless suffering. These conclusions challenge Western ethics' tenet that killing innocent humans is always wrong. We already allow severely disabled infants to die, often through prolonged suffering. This inconsistency means we treat animals more humanely, giving suffering dogs swift injections rather than slow deaths. World Bank researchers found 1.4 billion people living on less than $1.25 daily, absolute poverty, marked by constant hunger, lack of safe water, and inability to educate children. In 2008, 24,000 children under 5 died daily from preventable poverty-related causes. Meanwhile, absolute affluence means having income significantly beyond basic necessities. Most citizens of Europe, North America, Japan, and Australia qualify, along with hundreds of millions in China, India, and Brazil. Despite possessing transferable wealth, the affluent give little. In 1970, the UN set a modest target, 0.7% of gross national income for foreign aid. 40 years later, only 5 nations reached this level. The United States and Japan gave just 0.19% in 2008. If you pass a shallow pond where a child is drowning, you ought to wade in despite ruining your clothes. This reflects a principle. If we can prevent something very bad without sacrificing anything of comparable moral significance, we ought to do it. Extreme poverty is bad. We can prevent some without comparable sacrifice. Therefore, we ought to prevent some. This isn't charity. It's obligation. Many argue we should help those near us before addressing distant poverty. While we instinctively prefer helping those close, distance or community membership makes no moral difference. Just as we'd reject prioritizing based on race, we should reject prioritization based solely on citizenship. In a world where we can know instantly about suffering anywhere, old boundaries of moral responsibility have dissolved. The question isn't whether we can save everyone, it's whether we're willing to save anyone when doing so costs us only comfort, not survival.